Chapter 2, and that's where we will be picking up. I'm going to talk about something in terms of introductory material, simply because it has a little bit of bearing on what we're going to start talking about this morning with regard to the situation of these seven churches in Asia Minor to whom Revelation is addressed. We talked about some introductory material. What we didn't talk about are some questions and issues surrounding the precise date of Revelation. We're not going to go into a whole lot of detail on this, but I want to talk about it just a little bit. We've talked about the fact that the background of Revelation is a situation of persecution, a situation where Christians are being pressured immensely to give up their faith. With a few exceptions, most commentators are confident that what's in the background is persecution by government authorities under the Roman Empire. The question surrounding the date of Revelation is exactly when are we looking at? What period in the first century are we looking at? The New Testament, of course, the events of the Gospels in Jesus' life culminate around AD 30, 33. And of course, the events of the book of Acts carry us on through about AD 62. Some of the epistles are written somewhat after that. Where does Revelation fall in all of this? Let me start with a question. When, at the beginning of the book of Acts, who is responsible for all the persecution against Christians? Okay, it's the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem, first of all, and then unbelieving Jews in the various places to which Paul would go, for instance. There are times when they get the local authorities involved, but it's not a top-down persecution. It's more of a ground-up persecution, if you will. Grassroots persecution doesn't sound quite right, but that's what's going on there. It is not until the Emperor Nero that you have any record of active persecution against Christians. We're going to talk about four Roman emperors real quickly. Nero, who is actually the Roman emperor for a lot of the period in which the book of Acts takes place, most of the epistles of the New Testament are written during his reign. He reigned from AD 54 to 68. And even in the first part of Nero's reign, there was little, if anything, in the way of government persecution toward Christians. What happened was that in AD 64, there was this great fire that destroyed a large portion of the city of Rome. And there was a lot of suspicion that Nero himself may have had something to do with it. You've heard the old adage about Nero fiddling while Rome burned. The suspicion was that maybe Nero had allowed that section of Rome to burn so he could build a palace on the ruins of the stuff that burned down. Anyway, to divert suspicion for himself, Nero needed a scapegoat. And it just so happened that there was this group of people who were kind of on the fringes of society. They did things that a lot of people considered weird. And they didn't worship the gods that everybody else worshipped. And they had meetings together that were somewhat secretive, and they talked differently, and there was a lot that was different about them. And as a result of their being so different, a lot of people viewed them with a great deal of suspicion and hatred. Those people were called Christians, and they were a perfect scapegoat. So Nero decided to accuse the Christians of having started the fire, which, of course, we understand makes no sense. if you know anything about Christianity. But it made perfect sense as a PR move because everybody hated us anyway. And that was Nero's excuse to launch a wave of persecution against Christians, where he did all kinds of horrible things. Writers like Tacitus and especially Suetonius describe some of the terrible tortures and deaths to which Christians in Rome were sometimes put. It was, thankfully, very short-lived. Only lasted maybe 4 years at the most. Probably not even that long because Nero himself was having a lot of problems maintaining control and things like that. It's during that time, probably, that Paul is executed at Rome. It's around AD 66 or 67 is probably the date that that happened. And I'll say more about all that in a minute. After Nero, Nero was about to be assassinated, and rather than allow that to happen, he took his own life. And there followed what historians love to call the year of three emperors, Galba, Aldo, and Vitellius. They all reigned only for a few months each. So you don't even have really a whole year that passes between Nero and the next major emperor, who is Vespasian. Vespasian got to be emperor because of his success as a general and his popularity. He went to Rome to be the emperor and left behind the great war that he was prosecuting, which just happened to be in Judea against the Jewish revolt that started in AD 66. Maybe some of you are kind of familiar with that history. So Vespasian became the next emperor, left his son Titus behind to prosecute the war. Of course, in AD 70, Jerusalem was besieged and destroyed by Titus's armies, you can still see in Rome today the Arch of Titus, which is a commemoration of Titus's great victory as they brought back all these spoils from Jerusalem, including some things that looked suspiciously like they came out of the temple. It's also Vespasian who commissions the building of the Colosseum. Just a little historical note there. But there's not a whole lot of indication of organized, intense persecution of Christians under Vespasian's reign. Titus, his son, becomes the emperor after him, only reigns for a couple years, and he died. And then his brother, Domitian, and if you look real carefully at the bust, you can even see the family resemblance between Vespasian, the father, and Titus and Domitian, his two sons. Domitian became the emperor in AD 81, reigned till AD 96, was a terrible emperor, was a terrible person and a bad emperor, made so many enemies in the Roman Senate that after he died, they went about obliterating monuments to him as if to try and just erase him from the national memory. But there are a lot of historical sources that point to a pretty severe persecution of Christians that went on under Domitian's reign. The thing about this, and continued on into the second century and even the third, the thing about this is that a lot of times it was provincial. If you lived in this province over here and the local magistrates really weren't all that interested in persecuting Christians because they had other business to attend to, then you as a Christian might be left alone. If you lived somewhere else where it was a big deal, then you might have a lot of trouble. One of the particular things that seems to have been a problem for Christians in Domitian's reign had to do, not surprisingly, with worship. Not just the worship of the gods, but the worship of the emperor himself. It was customary, going back, I think, all the way back to Augustus, for after an emperor died, the Roman Senate usually would declare him a god, declare him a deity. It's kind of a posthumous honor. And in some places, you know, they might set up a temple in honor of, you know, an honor of the Emperor Augustus or Tiberius or whoever. And, you know, there might be a whole religious, you know, there'd be a priesthood and sacrifices could be offered, and he just became one among, you know, the whole pantheon of gods. You know, that was done with Nero. Nero was a sick individual and a megalomaniac, but he really had no interest in being deified as a god while he was still alive. He was too busy trying to show off. So he was content for that to happen after he died. Domitian seems to have been the first emperor who said, no, I want to be worshipped as a god while I'm still here. And just, you know, really, really was into that whole being regarded as a deity thing. And it seems that from the evidence we've got, in particular, the province of Asia was a place where people really went in for emperor worship, not just Domitian, but the past emperors who already died. In Ephesus, for example, there was they called it the Temple of the Sebastoi, which in the Greek equivalent of the Caesars, the Temple of the Emperors, dedicated to the deities who were the former emperors. And there's pretty good indication that during Domitian's reign, in Asia in particular, there was a lot of intensity of persecution against Christians, especially, who refused to worship the emperor. And you say, well, what about the Jews? Well, we'll talk about that as it gets along. And the answer is that in a lot of communities, the Jews and the authorities kind of had an understanding. And plus, Judaism was a much longer established religion. It had been there since the beginnings of the empire in Rome and in other places. Christianity was new. And the Jews were not talking about about having a Messiah who was a king, who was Lord. That was a title you were supposed to reserve for the emperor. By the way, you're there in Revelation chapter 1. Let's just think about this. If you're in chapter 2, look back to chapter 1. Verse 6. What does John say that God has made us to be in Christ in verse 6? All right. Kings and priests, or a kingdom of priests. Again, verse 9, John says, I, your brother and fellow partaker in the tribulation and what? Kingdom. Because we always think of that, rightly so, as a spiritual kingdom, we might not see that that kind of language could be considered treasonous, subversive. In fact, you know, that's how the Jews got Jesus crucified. Pilate wouldn't be impressed with their accusations about him claiming to be the Messiah, but claiming to be a king, oh, that was different. So all this talk about Christ being a king, about Christians being part of a kingdom, it's part of what created the problems. I said all that to say this. In terms of Revelation, dating it, most commentators fall into one of two camps as to when Revelation ought to be dated. Either in the reign of Nero or in the reign of Domitian, because those are both occasions when we have very solid evidence that there was pretty intense persecution of Christians. Real quickly, I'm going to explain why I lean toward the later date. And you know, you can study this on your own, and I'm going to tell you that it makes a little bit of a difference in terms of interpreting some of the specific symbols in Revelation, but it doesn't make a difference in interpreting its overall message, which of these dates you might choose to embrace. Again, we're talking about this really briefly because we got the letter to the Ephesians to talk about today. Couple reasons why I lean toward the late date. Number one is, for example, the letter we're talking about today, the letter to the Ephesians. Did you do a little research on when the church at Ephesus was established? Where do we read about that? Okay. All right. Acts chapter 18 and 19. All right. We read about Paul preaching at the church at Ephesus, and not just in Ephesus, but all over the province of Asia, the gospel spreading there. That's probably when a lot of these churches that Revelation is written to got started, as a result of the preaching that Paul did focus in Ephesus. We have a letter written to the church at Ephesus in the New Testament, the letter of Ephesians. And that's written, I think we can date the establishment of that church to, I think, around 57 AD, I want to say, 58, I can't remember exactly. The letter to the Ephesians is written around AD 61 or 62. And then, maybe a couple of years later, we have Paul writing his first letter to Timothy, and talks about Timothy being at Ephesus, preaching the gospel there. And quite possibly when 2 Timothy is written, Timothy is still at Ephesus. Now we're in 64, maybe 65 AD, somewhere along in there. We're right around the time that Nero's persecution begins. When you read Revelation 2, when you read the letter to the church at Ephesus, does this sound like the same church that Paul wrote to in the Ephesian letter? Scott says no. Why not?
Come on, when they're being addressed in Revelation versus whenever Paul wrote.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, because they had a lot of issues in the Ephesian letter, and it seems like they have,
okay.
It seems like they're very sound and doing what they're supposed to be doing for the most part.
Okay, all right. I think that's a fair analysis. One of the interesting things about Ephesians is Paul doesn't talk about any specific problems in the church at Ephesus that need to be corrected. And usually when there are, he is not bashful about addressing those things. You don't see that in the Ephesian letter. You do see some problems in 1 Timothy that Timothy's going to have to deal with. They're starting to happen. And in fact, Paul had spoken to the elders of the church of Ephesus and warned them, false teachers are going to come in among you, even from among your own selves. False teachers are going to arise and draw away disciples after them. Those things are beginning to happen when Timothy's there. In the letter that Christ pens to Revelation through John in Revelation 2, it seems that they have already been dealing with those things and dealt with them well, as if they're in the past. Not that they've stopped happening, but it's established. And I won't say that's impossible for a date of the end, or maybe even shortly, 68 or 69 AD. That's not impossible. But it, to me, makes a lot more sense if you're talking about a date toward the end of Domitian's reign, 30 years later. Jesus is going to say, you've left your first love. You've persevered. You've stood up against false apostles, but you've left your first love. If you're talking about 30, almost 40 years after this church was established, that's very easy to see. I'm not saying it couldn't happen in a shorter time frame than that. The other reason I lean toward the late date is simply this. You have some testimony from early Christian writers. These are not inspired writers. These are Christians from the second and very early third century, like Irenaeus, who was writing about Revelation and said of the vision that John had, that was seen not very long since, but almost in our own day, toward the end of Domitian's reign. Now, yes, this is written in 180 AD. That would be 85 or 90 years after Revelation was written, if it was written at the late date. But it's an early source that testifies that's when Revelation was written. Victorinus, who was an early Christian in the 3rd century, died at the very beginning of the 4th century, also writes, when John said these things, he was on the Isle of Patmos, condemned to the labor of the mines by Caesar Domitian. Eusebius, writing in the 4th century, quotes an earlier writer. Unfortunately, that earlier writer's writers' writings are not extant. All we have are quotations from them in other writers. Hegesippus, who wrote in the middle of the second century. Eusebius is quoting him 200 years later and says that he indicated that John was banished under Domitian. Those are early sources that point to the late date. That's why I lean toward that, you know, that later date under Domitian's reign. And here's the third reason. That persecution under Nero that we talked about, so far as the evidence tells us, Nero's persecution was limited to the immediate vicinity of Rome itself, the city of Rome. It was not an empire-wide persecution. It was really a personal. I don't want to call it a vendetta, but he needed a scapegoat and he needed to make it look like he was really mad at us and wanted to stamp out this, what he probably considered a weird antisocial movement. By the way, Christians were called atheists by the Romans. Does that seem really strange to you? We were called atheists because we didn't worship the right gods, including the divine emperors as they saw it. Not any indication really that the persecution under Nero would have been intense anywhere but right around Rome. In later emperors, Domitian and some of the second century emperors in particular, it is much, much more widespread. That's all I'm going to say about that. Okay. You can do your own homework on the dating of Revelation. It's a fascinating subject, and there's a lot of interesting thoughts. There are some writers that think it ought to be dated during Vespasian's reign, kind of in the middle of all of this. A lot of interesting thoughts floating around. It's not going to make a huge difference in the way we approach the book. But I wanted to talk about that in light of the situation at Ephesus that we're dealing with today. So let's talk about that for a minute. This first letter in Revelation 2 is written to the church at Ephesus. And we've already talked a little bit about the background there. Did we miss anything we need to know about the Ephesian church? No? Okay. All right. So we've got Paul preaching there. Oh, by the way, why did Paul have to leave Ephesus? You remember that? Okay, all right. Okay. Ephesus was home to, among other temples and shrines, the temple of Diana or Artemis, as it was the Asiatic name for her, that was this massive temple complex. It's listed among the seven wonders of the ancient world. And when Paul was preaching there, the gospel had such a dramatic impact. So many people were accepting it and renouncing idolatry that it was starting to cut into the local idol-making business. Okay. Paul didn't tell them, try to organize rallies to smash idols. People just did, people just got rid of them spontaneously because they had accepted Christ and recognized that that idolatry was wrong. And some of the silversmiths who made their living by fashioning these household versions of the idols of Artemis and probably some others, they got upset about that and they caused a riot. And remember that this riot ends up with this massive crowd in the local theater, and they're all chanting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Half of them don't even know why they're there. It's mob mentality. And the disciples decide Paul needs to get out of town for his own safety. That's the intensity with which pagan religion was pursued at a place like Ephesus. So it's not too surprising that that it may have presented a threat to the church there when Revelation is written. The other thing you need to know about Ephesus is it is a large city in New Testament times. It is a hub of commercial activity, overland trade routes, shipping port. It's a cosmopolitan place. There's people from all over the empire who are coming and going at Ephesus. It's like going to New York or Los Angeles or a place like that in the modern world. Gary. And that's
that kind of mob should get upset.
Sure. And that's a huge number for an ancient theater. Yeah. Yeah. You imagine you got 25,000 people in this theater and they're all yelling in unison, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," and Paul's wanting to go in there and make a defense of the gospel to these people and for a couple of hours they're in there and the disciples said, "Paul, you're not going in there. They're gonna kill you." So those are a few things about the situation at Ephesus. And again, emperor worship, just like the worship of a lot of other false gods, was alive and well in Ephesus as well, even though the New Testament doesn't mention it. It was alive and well at Ephesus, just like it was a lot of these other places. So in writing to this church, let's look at question number 4. What good things did Jesus say about the Christians at Ephesus? What have they done that he is pleased with?
They persevered.
Okay.
They didn't tolerate evil men.
All right. They've persevered. All right. He specifically says you did not tolerate evil men. You put to the test those who call themselves apostles and they are not, and you found them to be false. Paul in 2 Corinthians, for instance, alludes to some who made the claim of apostleship but weren't. And evidently, fellows like that ended up at Ephesus. Paul says, you put those men to the test and you proved them to be phonies. You stood up against false teaching, in other words. I know your toil, he says in verse 2. You have perseverance and have endured for my name's sake in verse 3 and have not grown weary. That's a good commentary on a church that when you open up 1 Timothy, for instance, or even Acts 20, Paul's address to the Ephesian elders, was looking at a future of some difficult times. So what that suggests to us is that the warnings Paul gave to those elders at Ephesus in Acts chapter 20, they paid attention. They heeded the fact that false teachers were going to arise and they made preparations for dealing with them. And it tells us that Timothy, Paul said, you're going to have to face down this kind of thing. You're going to have to encourage people. You're going to have to go after those who are going astray. That Timothy did that work at Ephesus so that some years later, this is what Jesus says about them. Okay. So that's good. That sounds like the church that Paul wrote Ephesians to, doesn't it? But what does he say next? What was the problem at the Ephesian church according to verse 4? Okay. What he says is, you have left your first love. What does that mean? Okay. All right.
That was a lot to say for a little
bit. No, but it was good. It was, yeah. Yeah. See, Scott did his homework, everybody. Roger? Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. See, here's where we always struggle with this. On the one hand, this is a church that had taken an admirable stand for the truth of the gospel. They had defended it, and they had exposed false apostles, and they had they had worked hard. They had endured evidently a lot of hardship, and of course when we tie that to the things that Paul warned about and the things in Acts 20 and in 1 Timothy, they were up against a lot, and they stood up against it. And we may have trouble reconciling that with the picture of a church that has somehow lost its way. That doesn't sound like a church that's lost its way, but it's a reminder that standing for doctrinal truth is not all there is. It is vital, but it is not all there is. Go ahead, Scott.
I don't want to talk too much, but everything I read, it's kind of scary, really, because Plant City could be in the exact same, I'm not saying we are, but we could fall into the exact same thing very quickly, and it gets a little scary when Jesus says, I want to remove your lampstand from you if this doesn't change. They were doing everything right, it sounded like.
Sure.
Very, very easily. I don't know. The more you read about the church and study this, the scarier it is that how fast, it wasn't but a couple hundred years later, not even that long, I guess, that Islam took over and the church was gone.
Yeah.
It did happen.
A few hundred. Yeah, Jeff? Yeah, and it's not presented as something they don't know. They know what they're supposed to go back to, and he's calling them to that. Gary?
Matthew 24, when Jesus was asked by some about what's for us in the future coming up, Jesus was talking about different things like aid and people falling away from the church, and he makes a statement in verse 12, because lawlessness is increased, most people love the hope.
Yeah, I thought Roger's suggestion was interesting, because it is one I've come across, that you've got a church, the possibility that you have a church that is focused on defending truth and just kind of closes in on itself. Sometimes when we're fighting battles against error, it's hard to be evangelistic, and it's hard to be kind. And maybe that's what's going on in Ephesus. I just wanted to entertain some of the possibilities by what Jesus might mean that they have left their first love. Scott's right that he does use terminology that you might use to describe a wife who's lost her affection for her husband in this case. She's still dutiful. They are. But perhaps they're doing the right things for the wrong reasons. There's a lot of possibilities that might come up when we talk about this church leaving their first love. what Jeff's comment is important, and that's that Christ calls them back to it. Verse 5, remember from where you have fallen and repent and do the deeds you did at first. So even, and even if this is, here's something else that's been suggested. If indeed this letter is written to the Ephesian church in, say, A.D. 95, say that's almost 40 years after Paul first preached the gospel at Ephesus, you might have what we sometimes call second generation Christians at Ephesus. And, I'm one of those. I think I'm third or fourth, I can't remember. But, you know, a lot of us are. And we understand the challenges of that sometimes come with being raised to believe certain things. We call it raised in the church a lot of times. Sometimes our beliefs are not as carefully thought out as they ought to be. They are not as intense as they ought to be. We're not as convicted about things as we ought to be. Those are things, hopefully, at a pretty young age, we start to come to terms with and realize we've got to make our faith our own. Maybe that didn't happen at Ephesus. I know this is a lot of maybes, because frankly, the statement's a little bit ambiguous. You've left your first love. We can think of a lot of things that might point to. And they're all big problems, aren't they? You know, if a church does what any of those things that we've just talked about that Ephesus might have done, it's going to be a problem. And by the way, you're going to see this with a lot of these churches. Some of these problems that not just Ephesus but these other congregations had might not have been obvious to outsiders and might not even have really been obvious to the people inside that church unless they really reflected on it. Because they were still going through a lot of the motions. And Jesus says, hold on a minute, I see what's going on there and it needs to change. So he tells them, repent, do the deeds you did at first. Or else, I am coming to you and will remove your lampstand out of its place. Remember the image of the lampstands in chapter 1, representing the churches. When Jesus says, I'm going to remove your lampstand, what is he saying to them? What's he threatening to do?
Not going to be a viable church.
Okay. That they're not going to be a viable church anymore? Or what if they keep on meeting and assembling? Are they not a viable church?
They're not going to be recognized.
Okay. That's right. They're not viable in the only sense that matters. He's going to stop recognizing them as his. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And that's a powerful threat. Especially for a church that's doing so many things right and has a history of doing so many things right. That history includes this, verse 6, yet you have this, that you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. So, I asked you to see what you could find out about the Nicolaitans. And to this day, Homer is absolutely right. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Nicholas was supposedly a deacon in the early church.
Right. It might be this, or it might be this, or it might have nothing to do with those. Yeah, those are fun. Go ahead, Will.
Yeah, I read that believers who compromise faith in order to enjoy sinful practices.
Yeah. And that would certainly be believable, because that's what's going on in several of these churches in various ways. That's what they're being pressured to do, is give up the elements of their faith that make them different from the culture around them. Guess what? We face the same pressure now to take the edges off Christianity as if it were. We can be Christians as long as we, you know, pretty much think and act like everybody else around us, then it's okay. Somebody else have a... I thought I heard something over this way about the Nicolaitans. No? Nobody? Okay. Again, Brother Haley's right. There is very little that is known about. This is the only place we see them mentioned in the New Testament, here and in the letter to the church at Pergamum, who unlike the Ephesians, they were putting up with the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Some of them were holding to it. Some think that this was a group, and for them to have a name like this, it seems to have been an organized and recognized group of people who taught that adherence to God's standard of morality, at least with regard to some things, was not all that important. If you've read through these letters, you see a couple of things in particular that keep coming up. Sexual immorality, eating things sacrificed to idols, which is a way of describing involvement in pagan worship and pagan idolatrous feasts, including those that might be held by, you know, your local trade guild that you were a member of or whatever. Those kinds of things. And adherence to false... Those things keep coming up over and over in the letters to these churches. And it may be that the Nicolaitans were a faction in some of these churches, or a group of influential teachers who maybe were Christians but were going astray, that were emphasizing, you know, you can be a Christian, but you know, you don't have to. The sexual immorality thing, it's all kind of relative. The idolatry thing, it's all kind of relative. We do know that by the second century you have a group of people called the Gnostics, who are in at least in some versions of Gnosticism teaching that, look, as long as you're spiritually in tune with God, then how you act in your physical body really is irrelevant. And that, you know, gluttony, drunkenness, sexual immorality, all that stuff, okay. You can see why that might be popular, right? And maybe the Nicolaitans were an early version of that. We just don't know for sure. What we do know for sure is that their teachings and their works were something that was contrary to the gospel. Jesus says, I hate it. The folks at Pergamum were embracing it. The folks at Ephesus had resisted it. And so they get commended for that as well. You're... And that's all we know for sure, isn't it? Yeah, that's really what we know. What we know with any certainty. What you have in Ephesus is a church that has done a lot of things commendably, but they still have a shortcoming that is serious enough that Jesus says, if it doesn't change, He's going to stop recognizing them as a church of His people. And that's scary. Some of these letters written to these churches, there's a couple of them where nothing negative is brought up about the conduct of the church. There are a couple of them where nothing positive is said. There are others, that leaves three more, where there's a mix of those. There's some good things and some bad things. Right off, we start with a church at Ephesus, one with whom, by the way, you have seven letters written to seven congregations addressing some pretty particular things going on in those congregations. Guess who gets to read them? Everybody at all of the other six congregations gets to read it. You think about that? Here's the folks at Smyrna reading, look what's going on at Ephesus. Whoa, Pergamum, whoa, what's up there? Okay, that could be embarrassing. These are open letters written to these congregations. What I want to say is, at Ephesus, you have a group that is doing a lot of things right, a lot of things that God commends them for, and yet there are some deficiencies that are so bad. And is So far as we're able to tell, are any of the Ephesian Christians eating meat sacrificed to idols? Engaging in idol feasts, pagan celebrations? Can't see it. Are any of them engaging in sexual immorality and saying, hey, this is okay? I don't see that at Ephesus. Are they openly embracing false teaching? No, they fought against it. And yet, Jesus says, you need to repent or I'm going to remove your lampstand. And that's why several of you have mentioned, you read this, it's a little bit scary because here's a church that is doing a lot of the things that rightly that we emphasize a lot. Don't get involved in sexual immorality. Stand up for the truth of the gospel. Make sure that the message being preached is correct. Fight against it when it's not. We can be doing all of that and still fail. We'll talk a little bit more about these letters on Wednesday. We'll look at the letters to the church at Smyrna and Pergamum on Wednesday night. And I thank you for all your comments today.